You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is Frank Rose, and I'm a senior fellow here in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. We're delighted to have such a large audience for our important and timely discussion today on the 2019 Missile Defense Review. We would like to thank our keynote speaker and the panelists for sharing their time and expertise with us this morning. Our program today we'll begin with a keynote from Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy, Plans, and Capabilities, Dr. James Anderson. Dr. Anderson has agreed to take a few questions after his opening remarks. After Assistant Secretary Anderson's departure, my friend and colleague, Brookings Senior Fellow Michael Hanlon, will moderate what I am sure will be a lively discussion with an excellent panel of experts whom I will let him introduce later in greater detail. This morning, we welcome to the Brookings Institution Dr. James Anderson, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy, Plans, and Capabilities. Prior to joining the Department of Defense last year, Dr. Anderson served 3 years as the Vice President for Academic Affairs at the Marine Corps University. From 2012 to 2015, he was Dean of Academics and Deputy Director of the Marine Corps War College. He also worked as a Professor of International and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall Center for European Security Studies, where he directed the program in Advanced Security Studies. I truly believe that working at the George Marshall Center in Garmisch is probably one of the best jobs in the United States government. Dr. Anderson previously served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as Director of Missile Defense, Middle East Policy and International Security Affairs, among other positions. In addition to working at the Pentagon and in academia, Dr. Anderson has also worked in private consulting and as a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He is the author of America at Risk, The Citizen's Guide to Missile Defense, and has published numerous articles and op-eds. In short, Dr. Anderson is well qualified to speak on the subject of missile defense, and we thank him for his time this morning. Please join me in welcoming Assistant Secretary of Defense James Anderson.
Thank you very much, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here. As alluded to in the introduction, I have worked at a think tank myself, so I'm well aware of the value of the think tank, and certainly Brookings has been at the forefront of public policy debates for decades on a wide variety of domestic, international, foreign policy, defense issues. So thank you for the invitation and this opportunity to share some remarks this morning. I would also say, by way of background, I would fully concur with your assessment of Garmisch and the Marshall Center. And as they say, if you don't like Garmisch, you will not like heaven. So it's an absolutely beautiful place. I'm going to pour myself a glass of water here. Okay. And as mentioned, I'm going to speak for a few minutes, and then I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. As many of you know, the Department undertook a series of strategic reviews beginning in 2017, including one on missile defense policy, strategy, and capabilities. We completed that review when President Trump formally rolled it out on January 17th. Today, I want to lay out the policy context of this review and the path it puts us on going forward. This review is closely aligned with the 2017 National Security Strategy and the 2018 National Defense Strategy. It has been conducted against the backdrop of a security environment that is, as these policy and strategy documents point out, more complex and volatile than any we have experienced in recent memory. Since the previous ballistic missile defense review was released in 2010, potential adversaries have been rapidly developing and fielding an expanding range of new and advanced offensive missiles capable of threatening the United States and our allies and partners. To reflect the expanding offensive missile threat, which includes non-ballistic systems such as advanced cruise and hypersonic weapons, we're calling this the Missile Defense Review. This is a noteworthy change from past policy and then one that reflects today's security environment. Evolving offensive missile threats make it imperative that we strengthen our current missile defenses and move towards new missile defense concepts and innovative capabilities. My remarks today will address the following elements. One, the evolving threat environment. Two, missile defense roles, policy, and strategy. Three, U.S. missile defense posture and capabilities. Four, working with allies and partners. And five, missile defense program management and testing. As emphasized in the 2017 National Security Strategy and the 2018 National Defense Strategy, the international security environment is now characterized by the reemergence of long-term strategic competition by revisionist powers. These powers are expanding and modernizing a wide range of offensive missile capabilities. They are engaging in increasingly aggressive behavior, including in outer space and in cyberspace. They are pursuing asymmetric ways and means to counter U.S. and allied conventional capabilities, thereby increasing the risk of miscalculation and the potential for military confrontation. The People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation are carrying out military modernization programs to increase the capabilities of their existing missile systems while adding new and sophisticated types of missiles to their arsenals, including hypersonic weapons and advanced cruise missiles. The current security environment is also challenged by states such as North Korea and Iran, who continue to modernize and expand their offensive missile capabilities. Let me say a few words about each. Over the past decade, North Korea, in addition to a vigorous nuclear testing program, has worked aggressively to develop ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads that can reach the United States, homeland, our allies and partners. While a possible path exists to peace with North Korea, North Korea's capabilities continue to pose a significant threat to the United States and others. Iran, which already possesses the largest ballistic missile force in the Middle East, is modernizing and extending the range of its ballistic missile systems. Iran's desire to have a strategic counter to the United States may lead it to field an ICBM, because space launch vehicles are inherently similar technologies to ballistic missiles. Progress in Iran's space programs could shorten the pathway to an ICBM if it makes that decision. Both large and regional powers are integrating offensive missiles more effectively into their coercive threats and military plans. These plans support their anti-Axis area denial, aka A2AD strategies, which seek to separate the United States from its allies and partners. They are fielding increasingly diverse, expansive, and modern regional and trans-regional offensive missile systems to inhibit our ability to respond to potential aggression. In this way, they seek to erode and undermine our security commitments to allies. And despite frequently criticizing the United States and its allies for pursuing missile defense capabilities, countries such as Russia and China have made substantial investments in their own missile defense systems. Russia has deployed more homeland missile defense interceptors than we have, and China is developing capabilities to counter long-range ballistic missiles as well. Russia is also seeking to sell, and has sold, missile defense systems across Europe and Asia, including to NATO nations. To address the evolving missile challenges to our security, the Missile Defense Review calls for a comprehensive approach to prevent and defeat adversary missile attacks through a combination of deterrence, active and passive missile defense, and offensive operations. Within this framework, the key roles for missile defense include protecting the United States homeland, forces abroad, and those of our allies and partners. Diminishing the benefits of adversary coercive threats and attacks. Assuring allies and partners that we will stand by our security commitments. Preserving our freedom of action to conduct military operations. And hedging against future unanticipated offensive missile threats. Additionally, a number of key policy principles will shape our missile defense capability and posture moving forward. We will size and field a missile defense force to stay ahead of projected missile threats to the homeland from such states as North Korea and Iran. We will continue to rely on nuclear deterrence to address the large and sophisticated Russian and Chinese intercontinental missile capabilities. Our missile defenses will defend U.S. forces deployed abroad and in support of the security of allies and partners against a full range of regional missile threats, and we will work with allies and partners to help them better defend themselves. We will pursue new missile defense concepts and advanced technologies, including disruptive capabilities such as space-based sensors and boost phase intercept to address the pace and the scope of evolving missile threats. Let me turn to the capabilities and posture that flow from our policy to counter these evolving threats. Our first priority, consistent with the National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, is to deploy a layered missile defense system to protect the United States homeland and stay ahead of rogue state ICBM threats. The United States is strengthening current homeland defenses in the near term and plans to pursue innovative and advanced missile defense capabilities for continued effective homeland defense over the longer term. Today, the United States is protected by the ground-based mid-course defense system against the threat of a rogue ICBM attack. And we are taking a number of steps to improve the GMD system. These include expanding the GMD system with 20 additional ground-based interceptors in Alaska, bringing the total to 64 fielded interceptors. We're also developing a new kill vehicle for the GBI, and we're improving the performance of existing sensors and deploying new missile tracking and discrimination sensors in both Alaska and Hawaii. And we are fielding a space-based kill assessment capability. The MDR also recognizes the need for improving our capacity to detect and defend against increasingly sophisticated cruise missile threats to the homeland. We are bolstering our homeland defenses against air and cruise missile threats accordingly. This includes a phased effort to provide more effective surveillance against threats to the national capital region. With regard to regional defense, as already noted, the regional missile defense threats to the United States forces abroad, allies, and partners has grown in both scope and scale. Potential adversaries are developing sophisticated offensive systems with increased speed, range, and accuracy, as well as advanced penetration aids. These offensive missile threats seek to complicate the defense of U.S. deployed forces, allies, and partners, and erode U.S. and allied will to respond to regional aggression. To address the regional offensive missile threat, we are focusing on strengthening our regional defense postures through the deployment of additional Patriot, THAAD, and Aegis interceptors, fielding mobile and relocatable missile defense capabilities to provide flexibility to respond to evolving crises and conflicts, improving the integration of regional ballistic missile and cruise missile defenses with offensive operations, and enhancing the interoperability and, where feasible, integration of U.S. missile defenses with our allies and partners to increase the overall effectiveness of our collective capabilities. Offensive operations for homeland and regional defense are one element of the comprehensive approach to missile defense that is needed to address today's complex threat environment. In the missile defense context, offensive operations to prevent, disrupt, or limit further damage from missile strikes can increase the overall effectiveness of our defenses by diminishing the burden on both active and passive missile defenses. Let me emphasize, these types of offensive operations are not new and come into play if deterrence and diplomacy fail and conflict ensues. Our budgets now reflect this new emphasis. DoD will sustain investments and capabilities necessary for attack operations as I have described, with improved attack warning, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and time-sensitive targeting, as well as long-range prompt strike capabilities necessary for destroying mobile missiles. Moving forward, our missile defense investment strategy and priorities will look at how best to counter advanced offensive threats and hedge against future unanticipated missile developments. It will do so in several ways. First, we will look to improve and adapt existing systems where feasible to enhance our missile defenses, including converting all Aegis destroyers to be fully missile defense capable. Conducting an SM-3 Block 2 Alpha test against an ICBM class target in 2020. Leveraging the Standard Missile 6 for both defensive and strike operations, and adapting the F-35 to track and possibly engage missile threats in the boost phase. Secondly, we will pursue new missile defense capabilities, including developing scalable, efficient, and compact high-energy laser technology, building a new ground-based radar in the Asia-Pacific region, and developing improved space-based sensors to track missile threats. Third, we will examine advanced missile defense concepts. In particular, we will initiate a study to look at space-based interceptors. This study will address what has changed in this area over the last two decades or so, and what are the costs, what is the effectiveness, and what the deployment modes and other considerations that would go into such a capability. This study is very much needed to provide updated information to support a potential future decision. Since the steady proliferation of new and more dangerous offensive missiles is a global challenge, the NDR highlights the importance of working with allies and partners to strengthen our collective regional missile defense efforts in Europe, the Middle East, and the Indo-Pacific region. In support of this security goal, we will work with allies and partners to procure interoperable missile defenses and integrate them where feasible with U.S. missile defenses. Moving towards interoperable and integrated air missile defense systems can take advantage of cost sharing and help distribute the burden of defenses to better address adversary A2 AD strategies. We're also placing a sharper focus on the pursuit of opportunities for increased missile defense contributions on the part of allies and partners to share more widely the responsibility of our common defense against missile attacks. In support of this, the administration has taken additional steps over the last 2 years to streamline policies governing foreign military sales to allow our allies and partners to more readily acquire U.S. defense capabilities. Finally, DoD recognizes the growing importance of timely deployments of effective missile defense capabilities in an era of rapid technological change. As the National Defense Strategy notes, we must prioritize speed of delivery, continuous adaptation, and frequent system upgrades to deliver enhanced performance at the speed of relevance. This especially applies to missile defenses. DoD must adapt processes and cultures that enable MDA and the services to deliver missile defense capabilities faster, to learn from failure, and to swiftly adapt systems once fielded. We must not fear test failure, but learn from it and rapidly adjust. Rigorous testing is a DoD priority because testing is a crucial part of the development and fielding of effective missile defense capabilities. To this end, DoD will seek ways to accelerate the tempo of the missile defense test program where feasible and continue to streamline and refine current flexible acquisition authorities used to develop, test, and field missile defenses. In summary, we will meet the growing risks and the danger of missile defense threats through a balanced, layered, integrated, comprehensive approach that combines deterrence, active and passive missile defense, and offensive operations if deterrence should fail. And by doing so, we will strengthen our ability to protect the homeland, enhance deterrence, protect and assure allies and partners, and hedge against future threats. This ends my formal remarks. At this point, I'm happy to collect some questions and address them accordingly. So I'll probably take three or four to start, and then, yes, sir, right here.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. John Harper with National Defense Magazine.
Okay.
Will that study of space-based interceptors look at
different sizing constructs in terms of, you know, the number of interceptors or satellites that would need to be positioned in space and sort of the efficacy and cost of these various options?
Okay. Let me collect a couple more. Yes, sir.
James Kiesling, I'm here as a private citizen, but somewhat of a missile defense expert. A question and a comment. Why did the study not expressly talk to budgeting priorities of missile defense as regards the nuclear deterrence, given that the actual hypersonic threats are all nuclear weapons? And then second, was the study aware that the Simorgh Iranian SLV is actually optimized as an ICBM?
Let's go over here. Yes, sir, in the front.
Thanks. Patrick Tucker with Defense One. It's sort of tangentially related to the MDR. Can you talk on the demise of the INF and what that changes for you in the immediately within the near budget cycle and what it changes over the next 5 years? Thanks.
And let me collect one more. Way in the back. Yes, sir.
Hi, thanks very much. Matt Korda from the Federation of American Scientists. You mentioned that the Missile Defense Review is wholly consistent with the National Security Strategy, but the National Security Strategy specifically states that missile defense is not intended to undermine the strategic deterrence of Russia and China. So how do you square that with the Missile Defense Review's emphasis on undermining, on countering Russia and China's ICBM threats, and specifically President Trump's remarks that we'll be able to shoot down any missile anywhere, anytime? Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you for the first set of collected questions. Let me start with the last one first. There is no delta or contradiction between the National Security Strategy and the Missile Defense Review with respect to Russian Federation and the PRC. In the Missile Defense Review, it states quite clearly that with respect to the large and sophisticated arsenals of Russia and China, we will continue to rely on our deterrent capabilities to deter them from aggression. So the current system that we have now and the projected enhancements that I referenced in my remarks are aimed at the rogue missile threat. In the form of Korea, North Korea today, with their existing capabilities, and also the potential that Iran may proceed along their lines. May proceed along the same lines in pursuing an ICBM. Now, all that said, it's also the case that if a missile is shot in the direction of the United States territory today. Regardless of the source, we are going to the maximum extent feasible, we're going to shoot it down. So that's important to note. With respect to INF, the question about how this changes, as many of you may know, the administration has been very concerned about Russian noncompliance. This, in fact, has preceded this administration. The previous administration first began to publicly point out Russian noncompliance in the INF in the form of the SSC-8 system as far back as 2014 with the State Department reports. And despite best efforts over the last 5 years, the Russian Federation has refused to come back into compliance. And so that prompted Secretary of State Pompeo in early December to declare Russia in material breach. This was supported by a very strong statement by NATO, concurring that Russia is, in fact, in violation. So where this leads to next is in early February, the United States is going to declare suspending its obligations under the INF and announce its the six-month treaty withdrawal that will end in the summertime. Now, all that said, it is still possible, although probably unlikely. It is still possible for the Russian Federation to come back into compliance, but I don't believe they will do so. What this points to is, in the larger context of increasing Russian capabilities within the European theater, and the United States, because we have scrupulously adhered to the parameters of the INF Treaty, we have limited our efforts strictly with research and development thus far. And if the treaty, if the Russians do not come back into compliance and the treaty does end, then we will continue along existing efforts with respect to potential systems that will be conventional in nature that could be used to increase our defensive capabilities in Europe. And let me emphasize that we are thinking about conventional systems in this regard, and that we have not made any final decisions on the type of conventional system, let alone any particular or potential basing of such systems. All this needs to be needs to be worked out in the future. There was a question about budgetary priorities. It is true that the Missile Defense Review does not speak in specifics about budgetary numbers, and nor should it. We will await the President's budget that will be forthcoming in the next few weeks, and I cannot go into detail on that, but I can say that we expect the budgetary priorities to be fully consistent with the emphasis emphasis in the Missile Defense Review on improving existing capabilities and exploring new concepts and developments. I would also note on hypersonics that the threat is not only the potential of a nuclear hypersonics, but also conventional systems as well. There was also taking the first question last, the question about the space-based interceptor study. Yes, yes, and yes. That will certainly take into account a variety of different factors. You know, the type of different architectures, the potential number of space-based interceptors. We'll look at cost, feasibility, practicality, timelines, everything that you would expect in a robust study. And yes, it is true that we have done studies on space-based interceptors in the past, but not recently. So we are looking forward to the results of this study. And the MDR itself, it does include a variety of taskings in it, a variety of studies, and I think it's noteworthy that they are measured in months. Most of them are due in 6 to 9 months, which reflects the urgency with which the administration views the current and evolving threat environment. At this point, let's go to the second round of questions. Yes, ma'am, right there.
Chia Ching with United News Group Taiwan. Facing China's growing military power that poses threat to U.S. interests in the region, does U.S. have a new strategy or an updated strategy in terms of maintaining the stability of Taiwan Strait? Thank you.
Yes, sir, right here.
Mark Bucknam from the National War College. You spoke about long-range prompt strike as offensive capabilities to assist with our missile defense. What do you see that being? Is that going to be ballistic systems? Is that going to be U.S. hypersonic systems? And what do you think the impact will be on strategic stability if we field those systems?
Okay, go back to this side of the room. Yes, sir.
Sir, George Nicholson with the Global Special Operations Forces Foundation. Yesterday, Brookings had a terrific event with the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Richardson. And one of the comments that Admiral Richardson made is the Navy is looking to get out of the missile defense business. The Missile Defense Review might give the service the off-ramp it has been looking for to stop sailing around in circles. waiting for ground missile launches. Comments?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's take two more. Yes, sir, in the back.
Sir, Duncan Kellogg, Partnership for Secure America. Part of the study that you guys are looking at right now when it comes to different space-based defense systems, do you think that's something that's going to exclusively focus on kinetic kill vehicles, or are we looking at something the same way that the Navy is looking at it from more of a non-kinetic or even non-visual capability? Thank you.
Okay, and there's one even farther back, that gentleman.
Yeah, hi, Rasmus Inderen, defense counselor from the Embassy of Finland. You mentioned strengthening the regional postures. I'm wondering what that means in the context of Europe. Is the plan to deploy new U.S. systems to Europe, or is it about retaining surge capability, boosting Aegis destroyer capacity, and selling more systems to Europeans?
Okay, let me start in reverse order again and say a few words about the European theater. Again, in terms of response to Russian INF violations, we have been abiding by the treaty with R&D, and we are evaluating potential conventional responses to be determined with potential basing modes to be determined in the future. Beyond that, we are also, in conjunction with our NATO allies and our friends and partners, we are increasingly engaged on the missile defense front. For example, we have NATO has an operational Aegis Ashore site in Romania. It has been operational since 2016. We are consistent with the European phased approach, adaptive approach. We are in the process of working on a second site in Poland, which will have the SM-3 Block 2 Alpha missile in it. And we expect that site to become operational probably in the next year. There have been some delays associated with that second site in Poland, but those have been related to military construction. They are not related to the capability of the system or any issues regarding Alliance desire to have that system there. We also have a number of destroyers that are based out of Rota, Spain, which are Aegis capable and committed to the European theater. Our friends and allies have a variety of sensor systems that they are developing. I'm thinking here of the Netherlands and Denmark that are sea-based radar systems that will be able to contribute to NATO's system. Right today at Ramstein Air Force Base, there's a Ballistic Missile Defense Operations Center that NATO has that is working to sort of integrate and take into account this larger picture. And all these efforts ongoing are aimed at threats emerging from outside the Euro-Atlantic area, in particular the threats emanating from Iran, as they have intermediate-range ballistic missiles that do threaten Europe at this point in time. So Alliance solidarity on missile defense issues is very strong. I've had the great pleasure to visit Brussels multiple occasions over the last 5 months since coming into this job, and many useful discussions with our NATO allies. In fact, on the missile defense review, we previewed the findings last fall, and then just last week I went over there with some colleagues to answer their questions. And the response, generally speaking, has been very favorable. There was a question about types of responses in terms of potential space-based interceptors, whether they would be kinetic or otherwise. The Missile Defense Review does point out sort of at least three possibilities in this regard. I mean, you could have a space-based system, kinetically based. We're also looking at directed energy, that is to say lasers, potentially on unmanned aircraft. And also the F-35 has currently has some sensor capabilities that can help us track and get a better read on threats, and may in the future also have intercept capabilities. So there are sort of different options out there that that study is going to look at. There was another question about Admiral Richardson and some remarks yesterday regarding the Navy, and I do know that you know, over time the Navy has periodically expressed on occasion some frustration with the you know, sailing around in small circles, but the Navy does have this mission of ballistic missile defense. It is one of their core missions, and it will remain so. And currently there are 38 Aegis or destroyers that are Aegis capable. And as pointed out by the Missile Defense Review, that number is going to increase to 60 destroyers. So with that increase of Aegis capable destroyers, I think the Navy is going to have more flexibility in terms of how it specifically allocates its ships. Here, you know, it's not simply a question of, you know, land-based interceptors or sea-based interceptors or potentially space interceptors, but the way that the Missile Defense Review looks at it is, you know, a combination, a comprehensive approach. So I expect the Navy to remain very much engaged in this mission area. There was a question about strategic stability and with respect to offensive systems. Here again, looking at kind of the integrated nature of how we think about missile defense, we think about it in terms of defensive systems and capabilities, but also if deterrence should fail, offensive strike capabilities. We believe our approach is, in fact, stabilizing, the MDR addresses that very explicitly. When we think about missile defense, in order to strengthen it, we really do have to have that offensive option if deterrence should fail. And finally, there was a question about the Taiwan Straits and passage through there, the freedom of navigation exercises that the United States has long conducted in those straits is continuing under the administration and will continue going forward. Freedom of navigation is a key principle that underlays maritime commerce, which the entire world depends on. So I would expect no change in that regard. So I have time for perhaps a couple more questions. Yes, sir, in the front.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Dwayne Hill.
Thank you, sir. Dwayne Hill from Booz Allen Hamilton. I had a question in regard to what extent did the Missile Defense Review consider space policy, and because there's a large emphasis on space, and also our efforts towards international space policy.
Yes, ma'am, right here.
Thank you so much. Caroline Gustafson with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. I was just wondering, one of the biggest concerns right now seems to be with technology increasing at such a rapid rate and us not really being able to keep up with it. And I was just wondering if there was any kind of initiative in conjunction with creating these defense systems to have more cyber security in place.
More what in place? I'm sorry?
Sorry, more cybersecurity in place, like in conjunction with building up these defensive systems.
Yes, sir, in the back.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary Arch Macy, an individual person. Just perhaps an administrative note, is this MDR intended to satisfy the requirements of the Missile Defeat Review tasked in the 2017 NDAA, or will that be separately addressed by the administration?
And maybe one more. Yes, ma'am, right here.
Thank you. KT Wang with NTD TV. My question is regarding strengthening the regional posture in Indo-Pacific. Can you just elaborate more about your priorities in the East Asia region, such as North Korea and China?
And one more. Yeah. Yes, sir, right there.
Thank you, sir. Ryan Taylor, Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. Close it up with this. What do you think is the most powerful change that this MDR provides to the defense establishment?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. I think in terms of the President Trump's initiative here, it's, in my view, it's clearly, the emphasis and the openness to explore new technologies and concepts moving forward. A number of things in this Missile Defense Review, are kind of longstanding or sort of initiatives that go back several years. But what President Trump and Acting Secretary Shanahan have brought here with this Missile Defense Review is a clear sense of urgency in terms of exploring these new technologies and concepts to keep ahead of the evolving threat environment, which actually ties into another question that we had about cybersecurity. As a matter of principle, in the document, it states very clearly that we are not interested in staying abreast or keeping pace with existing threats. We want to stay ahead of them. We want to lean forward, and that extends to any potential cyber risk to our existing missile defense capabilities. And I can assure you that's taken very seriously. I had the good fortune to visit Fort Greely in Alaska in December, which is always a thrill, and had a chance to talk to some of the personnel there. And they are very, very attuned to the security of that base, physical security of that base, and also the cyber security. So that's something that is not taken for granted, is under sort of a continuous review, and we're quite confident that our existing system is protected in that regard. But we will continue to be alert and keep a weather eye on evolving cyber threats as they relate to missile defense moving forward. There was a kind of a tasking administrative question. I believe that the MDR does satisfy that the particular tasking that that you mentioned. We always do want to be responsive to congressional reports, and we aim to do exactly that. We're also engage with our friends on the Hill with briefings and also with the rollout, and we are hopeful that there'll be sustained and predictable funding that we have had in the past moving forward in order to achieve the aims outlined in the Missile Defense Review. And there was a question about the People's Republic of China. And I can assure you that, the administration is very concerned about the proliferation of Chinese missile threats that do include testing of hypersonic technologies. We are keeping a close eye on that. It's very important for the United States to honor and maintain its treaty relationships in the Pacific region to ensure that our forces have freedom of movement, and that we maintain our power projection capabilities. And so the approaches laid out in the Missile Defense Review are designed to do exactly that. Lastly, there was a question about space policy and missile defense. So this is an area that, we're clearly already engaged. We've had satellites in space for decades. But we are certainly leaning in the direction of a space sensor layer that will help with evolving emerging threats, particularly hypersonics. And that's really important because the sensors that we have currently deployed, the satellites, you know, are very good at tracking objects in parabolic arcs, ballistic missiles in space that is cold and relatively empty, but tracking relatively low-altitude hypersonic missiles that may threaten us in the future against a cold and cluttered Earth presents a different series of technical challenges. So we are definitely leaning forward in exploring potential architectures for a low-orbit space-based sensors. So with that, I'm going to close. And again, Frank, and very much appreciate the opportunity to share some remarks. And thanks to all of you for your questions and your continued interest in missile defense. Thank you.
Assistant Secretary Anderson, thank you very much for your remarks. We're going to take a 5-minute break to change out and bring the panel up, but please join me again in thanking Assistant Secretary Anderson.
Do something like chew on the wire.
You can if you want to.
I promise to behave.
Michael, get it.
I know he will. That's why I'm going to behave.
Good morning. Well, hello again, everyone, and thank you for staying with us, even as the ice storm approaches. I couldn't help but notice Secretary Anderson's mention of potential additional capability for the National Capital Region for missile defense. I wouldn't mind just a little additional snow removal capability myself at the moment, not to mention a better Redskins team. But we'll get to our priorities on what should be in the president's budget and, more generally, what should be the nation's priorities in the discussion. We've got a great panel. I've got just a couple of questions I'm going to pose to them before we go to you, and we'll do all this by 12 o'clock. I'm going to start on the far left. You've already heard from Frank Rose, who I'll begin by introducing as a Knight of Romania. He was instrumental in the negotiations establishing the U.S. missile defense site in Romania, and for that he has been knighted in the great NATO member state of Romania, which is one of his attributes that's not frequently discussed, but I tend to admire greatly. He hails from American University and King's College in London and has had numerous positions in the government, most recently Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance. Important to keep all those words in your head when you try to understand Frank's approach to this kind of subject. And as you know, senior fellow here at Brookings. Next to him is my favorite super mom, super scholar, and a television commentator in Washington from the Hudson Institute, Rebecca Heinrichs, who is an expert on missile defense, among other matters of nuclear policy in particular. And like Frank and like Richard, she worked on Capitol Hill. In fact, the three of them used to spar a bit in a friendly way, en route to some very productive discussions probably roughly a decade ago. And one of the things Rebecca did was to help form the bipartisan Missile Defense Caucus on Capitol Hill, and has done a lot, therefore, to contribute to this debate and to the evolution of our budgets and our technology and our programs in this domain. And then finally, Richard Fieldhouse is a 25-year veteran of Capitol Hill and now is the president of Insight Strategies, but worked for Senator Carl Levin and then for the Senate Armed Services Committee in a long career there, with missile defense being among his chief focal points, and certainly he knows the programs and the technologies very well. And so I think the simplest way to begin is really just with a big, broad question to each panelist of what strikes them most about the Missile Defense Review. I don't want a primer. Of course, we've already had a pretty good primer from the Secretary, and I assume many of you have already looked at the document or at least press reports. So I would like to ask, what's the single most striking idea in the report, or departure from previous reports, or just the policy that you think requires the most attention? If I could just work down the line, Richard, starting with you, please.
Thanks, Mike. So it seems to me that the biggest change here is we have gone from what people thought of as a ballistic missile defense review, which we had in 2010, to a missile defense review. They've taken the B away from this one because it is not only about ballistic missile defense. So now this new review expands the aperture, if you will, to include not just ballistic missile defense, but also defense against cruise missiles, including advanced cruise missiles and hypersonic glide vehicles and hypersonic weapons. And that's really quite a large expansion of the missile defense approach and programs in the United States.
Great. Thank you. Rebecca.
Sure. If I could just very quickly, just three points. The first one is first of all, there's a lot of continuity from the Obama 2010 BMDR to the Trump 2019 MDR. The things that are different are, one, you now have Russia and China being discussed as threats in the context of regional missile defense, and that's where the hypersonic threats come in. That's different. Not to say that the Obama administration didn't take that into account, but it was not explicit in the BMDR, and we were still operating sort of under this official policy that even our regional defenses were geared towards the threats from rogue states, Iran and North Korea. So that's one difference. The second one is the emphasis of space as missile defense is dependent on space sensors. It gives a nod towards looking at studying costs and the technical aspect of space-based interceptors, which President Trump mentioned in his rollout of the strategy document. And third, I would say speed. Where the BMDR from 2010 focused on, you know, fly before you buy and trying to kind of go a little bit slower, cancel some of the more advanced technologies that we are working on. This MDR talks about making sure that we are operating at the speed of relevance, the speed of relevance. So we want to go faster. We got to go faster. When we're trying to actually deploy some of these missile defense systems to compete with great powers who do not have the bureaucracy that we have for our acquisition process. We simply have to go faster. It doesn't talk in great detail about how we're going to do that, but that's certainly something that the MDR highlights and sets out to do. So those would be my
That's great. Point. Thank you. I'm going to come back to the technology in a minute. But Frank, over to you, please, first.
I would say two or three issues. The first is, how do you deal with these more advanced threats, specifically hypersonics and others? And there's an examination of boost-phased intercept and space-based capabilities. I support looking at those capabilities, but I think we also have to remember we have tried boost-phased systems before, the airborne laser, the kinetic energy interceptor, and those programs were canceled for a variety of cost, technical, and operational issues. The second issue is, how do you deal with Russia and China's regional missile threat? I think this is a big issue, but I think there are serious questions about the role of missile defense in dealing with those challenges. Now, one thing where I will part a little bit with regards to what Rebecca said is that the Obama administration did have a more nuanced approach with regards to Chinese ballistic missile threats. The 2010 MDR says that the United States would respond to China's regional ballistic missile threats. Different than Russia. It's very much silent on Russia. But there was an evolution. But I think it comes back to this bigger question. Is there a role for missile defense in dealing with these regional threats from Russia or China, or should we focus on other technologies to deal with it? And then third, space. I agree that if we can get a space-based sensor capability to work, it would dramatically improve our terrestrial-based missile defenses. But we should remember, we have tried space-based missile tracking capabilities before in the SBIRS-LOW program, as well as the Precision Tracking and Space Surveillance System. Both of those programs were ultimately canceled for a variety of technical and cost issues.
Excellent. So what I'd like to do, picking up on where a lot of you went in your opening comments, is to explore a little bit more about technology and how we see trends, because let me state a premise, which you can challenge if you like, and then also ask a question. The premise is that among roughly peer competitors these days, offense has the advantage over defense. I'm just going to put that on the table. In other words, where we seem to be more able to do good things with missile defense these days is against North Korea, a much poorer country with a fledgling capability. And there, perhaps, defense has a halfway decent chance of being successful. But in general, when we look at the Chinese missile threat to Taiwan, for example, we tend to think of it as one we probably can't stop. These are conventionally armed warheads, of course, for the most part, that we presume might be used in an attack in that region. So the premise is that we are starting from a position of offensive superiority. My question for you then would be, where do you see trends going over the next 10 years or so? Because we've seen in the Missile Defense Review a lot of discussion of the threat getting more sophisticated, hypersonics, maneuvering reentry vehicles, other things that could complicate even current capabilities, ability to do their job. But then at the same time, we see a discussion of directed energy, space-based sensors, maybe even space-based interceptors, and some new opportunities that may arise. So to the extent that both offense and defense are improving, which one is perhaps improving faster, if that's even a meaningful frame? Obviously, I'm really just trying to invite a more general discussion of technology trends, but I'll put it in those terms to start and maybe ask you to begin, Richard.
So what I'll do, Mike, is kind of break this down a little bit in the first instance on the homeland defense piece, and then the second being the regional, because they really are drawn distinctly in the review and have been in the past, and it's a matter of our policy. So one of the things the MDR does state is that we, as a matter of policy, are not seeking to defend the United States against the advanced long-range missile capabilities of Russia or China, but are focused on defending the homeland against rogue nations, which for all practical purposes means North Korea, because they've been doing an awful lot. Iran is always there in the sort of side box, because we're ready if they should pursue an ICBM. So I don't think there's any suggestion that our technical capabilities are such that we could defend against a Russian or Chinese nuclear attack, and that there's a recognition about the stability problems that would be in place. I don't think either country would be interested in that as the outcome. On the regional side, however, there's a big push in the MDR to advance technologies for advanced threats, but those are not the long-range ICBMs from Russia and China. When it comes to regional, sort of the rogue countries, North Korea, Iran, I think we have been developing these systems that we're all familiar with, Patriot and THAAD and the Aegis program, and improving all those. But one of the things the MDR does is to change the emphasis, if you will, of our missile defense to include not only active defenses, but now includes a focus on passive defenses and on offensive attack operations as a component of missile defense. I think logically recognizing we're not going to build up, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of these interceptors to match all the interceptors that other countries have. So there is a change in emphasis, recognizing, and the MDR is clear about this, that we're not going to have as many interceptors or more interceptors than potential adversaries have offensive missiles. So that's I'll frame it that way.
That's great. Thank you. Rebecca, over to you, please.
Sure. So where to begin? So I think a couple of things on what Richard said. So the report, it is true that the report makes clear that the Homeland Missile Defense System is still going to be looking to stay ahead of the rogue missile threat, Iran, North Korea. And then it allows for a hedging. So if we need more interceptors, that the president decided to increase the number of ground-based interceptors, that's what we have to protect the homeland against ICBM threats. We're going to have 64 by 2023 at the earliest. The president requested those in 2017. And then the report talks about some different things we're going to do to increase the reliability and the capability of that system. If the administration decides we need to have more interceptors to stay ahead of the advanced threat, then we're prepared to do so by having a third ground-based interceptor site, because we have the environmental impact studies done for that, deciding where we want to put that. Or we can increase the Alaska fields up to, I think, 104 or 100. 100, 104. So those options are there. Something interesting in the report, though it says that that Homeland Missile Defense System is there to primarily defend against rogue states and accidental or unauthorized launches, leaving the adversary silent on that point. We're talking about Russia and China, accidental or unauthorized launches. It also says that the United States is not going to permit any limitations on homeland defense to get ahead of the advanced threat. And as we do have space sensors, which talk to anybody in the administration from General Hyten at the Pentagon to Dr. Griffin, Undersecretary for Technologies, Research and Technologies, everybody talks about the hypersonic threat. That is just like primary. And they're talking about it mostly vis-a-vis China and the threat that we think that they are really looking at Taiwan. And the DIA recently released a report on the Chinese threat, and it highlights this. And we're worried about them holding our carriers at risk. So that is what they're really concerned about. And having space sensors is the thing that we can do that's really going to give us the ability to have it's called birth-to-death tracking of these hypersonic weapon systems that fly low to the earth, and that we can't possibly see them if we just have land-based or sea-based systems from birth to death. So we really want to have that capability. Those space sensors are also going to help that homeland missile defense system to help us stay ahead of the threat from North Korea and Iran. As we continue to work on the rogue state threat, you're going to see that line being blurred between rogue states and peer competitors and the sorts of threats that we can do. Not to say that our homeland missile defense system is ever going to be designed to handle every single ICBM that Russia or China could throw at us, but perhaps could get to the point where we are increasing in their minds doubts that a strategic initial attack would be worth the cost. And so you can, though the report, again, I want to be clear here, the report does not say that we're going to be moving to defend the homeland against those peer competitors, but it is rather silent, saying that we're still going to primarily rely on nuclear deterrence for those strategic threats from China and Russia. But it is an interesting, it is interesting to watch as our technologies improve, this hard line that a lot of people like to see between rogues, a defense of rogue states and peer competitors is just going to be increasingly blurred because the rogue state threats continue to advance. I'm going to leave it at that, or I'll
great.
Just keep talking.
Thank you. That was great.
No, thanks, Richard and Rebecca. I think you both made very, very important points, especially the point, Rebecca, that you made on space sensors. If we can get this to work, I think it would dramatically improve our ability to discriminate against more and more advanced threats. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we had two previous programs, SBIRS-LOW and PTSS. They were canceled. But we did have two demonstration satellites, the STSS satellites. They were these old SBIRS-LOW satellites that we found in a closet. And we said, boy, there's something here. And MDA actually launched them. And the information that those demonstration satellites have provided have been very, very good. So I think we should pursue that, but we also need to take into account the lessons that we've learned from our failures. Mike, I see really two challenges that we need to be focused on as we move forward on missile defense. First, I think you raised it a little bit earlier with Dr. Anderson, is the cyber threat. There was a big GAO report earlier, I think last year, which basically said there are serious concerns about the cybersecurity of our missile defense systems. Cybersecurity has to be number one as we move forward. This is critical. I tend not to silo space, missile defense, cyber, nuclear. Indeed, I think they are becoming more and more integrated. So if we are going to be serious about missile defense, we also need to be serious about cyber because they are interconnected. And the second, and this is a longer-term challenge, is right now I think our hit-to-kill systems can meet the mission that we currently have, dealing primarily with the rogue state threat. But as we move forward, we're going to have to find a way to deal with more advanced threats, number one, and two, get ahead of the cost curve. For example, an SM-3 Block 1B missile cost about $9 or $10 million a round. That's very expensive. So we're going to have to look at some new technologies to get us on the other side of the cost curve. One promising technology potentially is directed energy, but we are not where we need to be right now on developing a deployable solid-state laser that can be operationally effective.
I want to follow up on that, please, and then I'm going to have a question on the budget, and then we'll go to all of you. When we think about what's realistic in terms of new technologies, I just want to put a couple of hypotheses on the table and ask you to respond. And we've seen a lot of studies over the years on everything from space-based ballistic missile defense, not just sensors, but interceptors. And we've heard a lot of talk recently about directed energy. Admiral Richardson just mentioned it yesterday in his presentation and interview with me here. But directed energy is, as we all know, subject to the fact that when you're further away from the origin of the beam, or whatever it may be, the beam inherently and inevitably weakens. And therefore, the kind, and not to mention atmospheric effects, so the kind of range that we can realistically expect, even for improved lasers, strikes me as probably in the range of miles, tens of miles, maybe low hundreds of miles. With anything that's even being conceived today, I think it's pretty hard to get into the high hundreds or thousands, which means that it's a hard system to think about for homeland defense, unless you could be in space. But space-based laser technology remains extraordinarily difficult. It's essentially putting up a Hubble telescope and a huge laser for every single weapon you need to have, and you have to have them fairly low altitude. Yeah.
because you can't be too far away from the target, which means they keep moving relative to the Earth. So the absentee ratio means that you need to have a lot of weapons in space for any one you might use. That's a long windup. Simply to ask you all, aren't there some pretty significant constraints still on what we can realistically expect from technology? And yes, if we're thinking about a theater defense, or if we're thinking about a specific small country like North Korea, which is geographically small and near international airspace and near U.S. allies, we may have a lot of options. But if we're thinking about, again, a regional conflict against a China or a Russia, leave aside the homeland defense mission, just the regional defense mission, it's going to be fairly hard to think that defensive technologies are really going to become predominant in the next 10 years. So that's, again, a mouthful. But I'd ask you to comment on the limitations of some of these new technologies that the report alludes to and hopes a lot from, but where we already know physics and engineering impose some pretty severe constraints. Maybe I'll go in the same order one more time if I could.
So you've given us a lot to consider, Mike. We had a favorite old joke on the Hill as we considered many, many budgets where there were requests for funding for high-energy laser development, and it was, high-energy lasers are the weapon of the future and always will be. And what we have seen from many, many years of efforts, Frank mentioned the airborne laser system. We spent over $5 billion on that. That was a Boeing 747 filled with chemicals for a laser with a very sophisticated beam. It didn't meet the requirements. It was Secretary Gates who canceled the program, saying that its technology was not sufficient, that its operating range was not sufficient, that it would have to be so close to an adversary nation as to put the aircraft at risk. And that's not a very good operational concept if you have to put the airplane at risk just to do the mission. A Boeing 747 is, you know, a pretty big aircraft, pretty easily visible to radars, things like that. So the way I look at this from a lot of perspective of these advanced technology programs is there's sort of the real and the now, which are the programs we're working on and are in place now, we're improving them. And then there are the sort of the efforts for advanced technology, which are, you know, the challenges are really significant, especially when you're not talking about ballistic missile defense, where you have a pretty good idea where the missile should be. But if it's now maneuvering threats, that's a great deal more challenging. So I think the way I would put it is the programs that you talked about, which are, you know, directed energy, space-based lasers, things like that, there will be research, there will be studies. I think actually the MDR has 12 taskings and reports in it that are due within the next year to look at a variety of these things. These are not answered questions. This is still very much exploration and seeing what the art of the possible is, but we're not in a position to be counting on any of that today or near term the way this is described. They're still looking out in the future.
So, Rebecca, the same question to you, or to paraphrase Ash Carter when he wrote about this 30 years ago, what are the limits of the possible, the realistic limits of the possible?
Sure. I'm not an engineer. I'm the daughter of one, so I've got some of the
DNA.
Yeah, some of the DNA in there. But I can tell you from all of my briefings and from talking to different engineers what they're saying, and there is a range. You know, there's a range depending on who you kind of talk to. The one thing I will say about the airborne laser is, from my memory, most of the criticisms of that particular program were the CONOPS. It was the 747 flying over places that are going to try to shoot at it. So that was the main sticking point with that particular program. Now, the technology in it, the guts of the thing, was pretty interesting. And in fact, after the program was canceled, it did have a successful test where it was able to shoot down a boosting missile. And so the laser technology is still interesting enough to keep people very motivated to invest in this technology. Now, there's another directed energy joke that it's always 15 years away, always 15 years away or 10 years away, depending on who you talk to. And we never seem to be getting that number down any smaller. I have seen an increased optimism that we are getting that number down smaller in recent years. It depends on what kind of platform we want to put it on, though. So I'm still optimistic that we are making progress on the directed energy concept for boost phase application. Now, when you talk about space, Most of the conversations I'm a part of when we talk about space-based interceptors are still not, that directed energy would still be further away. We're still looking at kinetic options for space-based interceptors. And on that particular point, that's going to require a very significant commitment on the part of this administration to make that policy decision to invest in that, to see if we can get an initial program started. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that in this particular context for this subject, we've been talking about the Missile Defense Review as the report, you know, says. We also have President Trump's remarks that he made at the Pentagon for the rollout of the Missile Defense Review, and it was much more ambitious. He certainly did not make the distinction between Russia and China and defending against Iran and North Korea. And that's very interesting and should not be, I think, discounted or discarded. I think what he made the remark that we're going to space and we don't want missiles to have we didn't want to allow them to have any place where they could be without being threatened by an American missile defense system. And so it will be very interesting to see. I don't think that what he said conflicted with the Missile Defense Review, but you have to look carefully at the words used in the Missile Defense Review. And I've laid that out in greater detail if you want to look at that at Hudson Institute, where I'm a scholar. But it will be. It's going to come down to what's in the budget. It's going to come down to what's in the budget, what we see, and where Congress can get behind and find some consensus for the balance between investing in mature technologies that we have, giving them what I believe is an absolute necessity, which is space-based sensors. I think that we have kicked the can on that far too many times, and we're out of road. So we need to get space-based sensors. But then if you look at the concept space-based interceptors, some of these sportier things, you're going to have to look in the budget. And as I have been told many times by administration officials is it might not just be in the Missile Defense Agency budget. I thought Frank made a great point that you have to look across. It's going to be integrated. The space domain, we can't look at it anymore like it's a zone stovepipe domain. It is a military domain. And that is not the fault of the United States. Our adversaries have been very busy in that domain. And so we don't have a choice but to integrate it across domains. So, and with the Space Force, there's going to be some other things, I think, in these other budgets that are going to have applications for the missile defense mission.
Great. Well, I would agree with Rebecca that there have certainly been improvements in the directed energy arena over the past decade or so, especially with regards to solid-state lasers. And we've also seen the improvement of drone technology. But I would argue that there are still significant operational and technical challenges associated with boost phase defense as well as directed energy. In preparing for today's panel, I went back and looked at the 2003 American Physical Society report on boost phase intercept, and many of those same issues that the American Physical Society laid out back in 2003 remain. Now, on airborne laser, yes, the operational concept was very, very difficult. You needed a lot of aircraft, but it was another problem as well. It used a chemical laser, and it is very, very operationally difficult to operate a chemical laser in a war zone. It's just really messy, and that's one of the reasons why ABL was eventually canceled. Yes, it did have a successful test, I think back in 2009, 2010, but from an operational perspective, I think people understood that chemical laser technology probably was not effective. Now, the key question, and this is the question to ask to the scientists and engineers, at some point in the near future, can we develop a small enough solid-state laser that can be deployed on a drone or a ship that has enough power to intercept ballistic missiles or other types of missiles? I'm not sure. I think it's an open question. I personally believe we do have to look at these new technologies, but we also need to be very realistic about what's achievable and affordable.
So thank you. Let me pose my last question, and we'll maybe go in reverse order on this, starting with you, Frank, and you finished on the word affordable. We know from the Missile Defense Review, it says that we spent $15 billion on missile defense in the first year of the Trump administration, partly because we were focused on North Korea. We got a supplemental. We had an acute crisis in 2017, and we were – I don't know how that $4 billion was spent, but if nothing else, I'm glad we sent a message to Chairman Kim that we were aware of the need to be ready. And so I think there was an argument at that point for a plus-up. But the norm has been more like $10, $11 billion, although, Rebecca, you pointed out that now there's getting to be a blurring of the programmatic lines to some extent, and I'm guessing that'll be part of your answer. But what's the right number? And we know, again, hearkening back to President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, which was in a different world against a different categorization of threats, but it was not quite as much money as we're spending now, even when you adjust for inflation. I think Reagan's budget was in the $8 to $9 billion a year range, if you put it in 2019 dollars. So we're already a little above that. Should we be closer to the $15 billion as a steady state, the peak that we reached early in the Trump presidency? Is the $10 or $11 billion number overall about right? Does it all depend on when we get a massive deployable system that might work? How would you frame the budgetary question, especially in light of the fact that we have a $1.3 trillion offensive nuclear force modernization agenda in the works, as well as the distinct possibility of not getting the 3 to 5% real defense budget growth that the National Defense Commission and others have called for as what they think is needed to fund the full defense program?
No, Mike, I think it's all about the Benjamins. I learned about that. One of my attorneys said, that's a key phrase in all the rap music. It's all about the Benjamins. I said, Ron, how do you know that? He goes, well, my kids listen to rap music. I don't listen to rap music. But it all comes down to the funding. I think the challenge missile defense is going to have, number one at the macro level, is, as you noted, we have some other very, very significant funding challenges in the defense budget. Probably one of the biggest is the modernization of our strategic nuclear deterrent. Now, I've been out there very, very clearly that we need to modernize, we need to maintain a triad, but I've also been very clear is there's only so much money. So I think the challenge that the missile defense program will face is how do we maintain our current capabilities at the same time incrementally improve them to deal with evolving threats, and thirdly, look to the future, so to make sure we don't fall behind as the threat evolves. That is going to be challenging at $10, $11 billion a year. What that leads me to think is priorities are going to have to be made. The Missile Defense Review lays out a whole smorgasbord of options. We are not going to be able to afford everything that is outlined in the Missile Defense Review. So that's going to require the Department of Defense and Congress to exercise very, very tight oversight and be prepared to cancel programs which are not performing. And I will tell you, as a former staffer on the House Armed Services Committee, it is very, very difficult to cancel programs. I still have shrapnel in my back from when I tried to kill the airborne laser. So we'll have to see whether they'll be able to do it. But it's going to be a big challenge, especially when you look at the overarching defense budget with the recapitalization of our nuclear deterrent, but also our conventional capabilities. Mike, as you and Jim Miller wrote, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, they all want to grow the force. Something is going to have to give. Whether the executive branch and Congress will be able to make those decisions, that's the open question.
Thank you. Rebecca, over to you. Yeah. Same question.
I wanted to just mention that back, what was two years ago, the height of fire and fury, when the rhetoric was kind of going back and forth between Kim Jong-un. I just cannot call him Chairman Kim. I have a hard time
doing
enough.
That. Fair enough. And if you think of something worse, that's fine, too.
Well, the president's given me some ideas, but I won't bring them up here. But anyway, Kim, I mean, when the president of the United States and Kim Jong-un were going back and forth with this very heated rhetoric, the North Koreans, my goodness, I mean, the Kim Jong-un has tested more missiles in his time than his father did over the length of his rule. He got to the point where he tested an ICBM that was a monster. It surprised the most diligent North Korea watchers I know of were surprised at the monster of the ICBM that they tested. And so things were getting very, very serious. And that's when I decided to take a trip up to Fort Greely to check out our missile defense system, which everybody was already sort of nervous because all of this was going on, and the site was prepared and on guard to be called to duty, to action, if they needed to do that. And I was climbing in and out of the silos and checking everything out. And by the way, you know, GMD has a bad rap, I think, for having a spotty test program. But I will say that of the interceptors that are currently deployed, to give everybody a little bit more maybe confidence in our homeland defense system, of the current interceptors that are deployed, those interceptors are 5 for 6 in flight tests. So it's not the same system that was initially rolled out when the Bush administration got out of the ABM treaty and we rolled out this GMD system. But I think it's funny, in hindsight, I chose not to tell my escorts that I was actually pregnant at the time. So I was everybody else was already on pins and needles, and here I am pregnant, climbing in and out of interceptors at the height of fire and fury. So I don't know if that was the smartest thing I've ever done. But I will say, you know, it in terms of realistic and budget numbers, I think it's a I don't care if they're in black accounts. I don't care if some of this stuff is, especially on the space stuff that we're doing. But we have to increase the number. So I'm hesitant to give an actual number because I don't know where it's going to be in the budget. And so I don't want to just look at the Missile Defense Agency budget. And everything that goes towards the missile defense mission is going to be determined first by that top-line budget. Is it going to be $700 billion or $750 billion? The president now and the Pentagon all say $750 billion is the number that we need. And that's what the chairman, the ranking member of the HASC and the chairman of the SASC are saying. The Democrats now that have control of the House think that that number is way too high. And so we have to figure out what that number is first before we can even look at, okay, now how do we prioritize the missile defense mission? Now, I think the other thing that the report does, aside from trying to get the missile defense mission out of just this idea that it's just in the Missile Defense Agency budget and that it's integrated across different budgets and different domains. The other thing it talks about, it has a big emphasis on that the missile defense mission contributes to deterrence. Okay, so it's not just nuclear deterrence or conventional weapon deterrence. We want to have defense incorporated as we think about deterring our adversaries. If we can just raise their doubt just a little bit to change their calculus to think that firing on the United States, what we value most, our allies and our deployed forces, if we can get them to change that calculus, that would be money well spent. And so as I think we think about this, especially as the United States is very reluctant and increasingly reluctant to intervene in these military conflicts, if we can really get a more muscular deterrent strategy for some of these adversaries, that would be money well spent. So in the past, I've said that the Bush administration FYDP, I don't remember the last numbers, the last year that would have been, but it had this around $10 billion for the Missile Defense Agency. So we're very short of that. And so I do not think it's unreasonable that the budget should be around that high of a number. If you're talking about investing in advanced technologies and getting some of this stuff right, increasing the capacity of systems in the regional context, especially as we worry about Poland and our Eastern and Central European allies vis-a-vis Russia, and as we are concerned about Japan and South Korea vis-a-vis not just North Korea, but then as we really take into account the Chinese threat. So the number is going to have to be significantly higher than this $7.5, $8 billion in the Missile Defense Agency budget.
Thank you. And Richard, same question to you.
So I'm going to be a bit of a contrarian, just state out front. I'm not a believer in a magic number, mm-hmm. right? There is no magic number for any of these programs. other than, if you will, what Congress finally decides. That's what the number will be, and we would do very well to remember that always, because that's where the rubber hits the road. That's where the actual programmatic possibility arises, when these programs are funded. And I'm a bit of a skeptic, if you will, on just the dollar charts to say, you know, here's how much we spent versus how much in this time. It's about the capability you're trying to acquire and what you need for the mission. And that varies as the cycle of development and deployment sustainment continue. You know this very well, Mike, about the cycles of funding and, you know, how much you have to put in early in a program versus then when you're going to start procurement and operations. So it's not like there's just a steady line or steady funding state for programs, although ideally every program manager would like to have predictable, stable funding. One of the dangers that you have when you have budget peaks is that if you ramp up funding and then the support for those programs does not continue, the funding can fall pretty substantially and cause real programmatic disruptions, and it's really a turmoil to try to keep a program going. So I do want to add a couple of the ingredients in this soup that people should be aware of. One is the Budget Control Act. Budget caps are coming back. They're going to be in place for 2 years unless Congress waives them, and I wouldn't bet money on that. As you said, we have a considerable budget problem. You also have a new Democratic majority in the House, which I think is going to have a different perspective from its predecessor in the House in terms of funding and defense funding levels and what are their priorities in terms of where the defense budget goes. And there's going to be a big affordability issue with all these other programs we've talked about. And Frank mentioned it, Rebecca mentioned it. All the other things that the Department of Defense wants to do, there's not going to be enough money in their budget request to do them all. And so there are already competing funding sort of challenges within those budget interests. The other thing is a lot of what is mentioned in the BMDR, it's a roadmap. It's not a programmatic document. And a lot of the things they're talking about, as I mentioned, are still being studied or will be studied over the next 6 to 9 months. These are not things that will necessarily be in the FY20 budget, and some of them won't really be ready for funding for several years. They'll have to answer a lot of questions. Is it cost-effective? Does it make sense? So I think the budget picture and the affordability questions are really among some of the biggest questions about this. We won't really know any details about what the administration's actual budget prioritization are until the budget request comes out, and then Congress has a chance to really wrestle with that over the year. But my going-in assumption is that it will be challenging to get all of the expected or requested funding to go through easily this year.
Well, let's go to you, please. I think we'll take three questions at a time. In a perfect world, we'll have roughly one question per panelist, so we can. But you can feel free to identify the person you would like to have respond or not as you see fit. I think we'll start in the back more this time, because so why don't we take the woman in the scarf, and then the gentleman standing up, and then we'll take one more. Let's see who else in the back, and also the gentleman here standing up in the white shirt.
Hi, I'm Teresa Hitchens with the Center for International Security Studies at the University of Maryland, and I want to thank the panel for a comprehensive discussion. I want to ask a question that kind of goes off the practicalities, but more in the realm of questions of actual deterrence and strategic stability. Rebecca, you mentioned that you see this blurring of the line between missile defense against rogue states and new threats from peer competitors, and I see that too in the Missile Defense Review, but more so in what President Trump said. And your contention is that missile defense is stabilizing. And mine is perhaps that that's not true. If you actually look at the potential responses from Russia and China, one would be to increase their nuclear capabilities, to increase their nuclear forces and architectures as a response to what they see as undercutting of their own deterrent and an undercutting of strategic defense. This is particularly true with regard to any move by the United States to move towards space-based interceptors. Russia and China have for two decades been saying that moves by the United States towards that would require them to rethink their own nuclear architectures and anti-satellite weapons capabilities. So I would like the panel to address that question of strategic deterrence and strategic stability with regard to putting missile defense more in the spotlight of deterring Russia and China.
Thank you. Gentleman here.
Hi, my name is Sang Min. I'm a reporter from the Radio Free Asia. I want to ask about the North Korean missile threat. I want to know how to see new MDL describe the preparation for North Korean missile threat. So there may be something change, some development. So I want to know how to see that. Do you think that is relevant to deter North Korean missile threat?
Thank you. And then over here, please.
My name is Duncan Kellogg, Partnership for Secure America. First, thank you to the panel. This has been incredibly enlightening. This kind of goes to anyone, but Rebecca, you in particular talked about the president's potential decision to look at really investing in space-based interceptors and looking at that as a potential opportunity. Kind of building off of the first question, that occurs to me and I think many in the audience that would represent kind of opening Pandora's box with regards to the Outer Space Treaty. So looking at putting interceptors in space, while it might provide an incredible capability, I wonder if you guys can speak to the relevance of whether or not not necessarily coming in breach of that treaty, but bringing other countries into the spotlight of whether or not they would decide to put their own capabilities into space and whether or not that would provide a capability that violates that treaty. Thank you.
Rebecca, you want to begin, and then we'll go to either Frank or Richard.
Sure. First of all, I'll just do the North Korea threat real quick.
Please.
So we're coming up on the second summit between the president and Kim Jong-un. President Trump likes to highlight, often does highlight, the fact that we haven't seen any more flight tests from missiles since the Singapore summit. That is true. That is a great thing. We're all happier when they're not testing missiles, especially the kind that fly over our ally, Japan. But there has been no indication from anything that I have seen that the North Koreans have taken steps to dismantle their nuclear missile program, either the nuclear part or their missile part, which I see as hand in glove. You can't separate the two. Okay, because they invest in these monster ICBMs because they want to be able to hold the United States at risk of a nuclear attack. I have seen no indication that the North Koreans have moved away from desiring to maintain this capability. And in fact, there is some indication from open source, viewing of what's going on, that they continue to perhaps increase capacity. So they're still making missiles. I have no confirmation of that. That's just been reported in the media by others who use commercial satellites to see what they're doing. So I'm still very concerned. I see nothing indicates to me that something has happened with North Korea that would make us less committed to increasing our homeland missile defense to make sure that we take away that ability they have to hold the United States homeland at risk. If that answers your question. And I think that the question that was asked over here, even though she and I might completely disagree on it, I think that that is the million-dollar question that everybody who's interested in the subject should be thinking about and sort of chewing on. And then that goes to the third question that was asked. Nothing in the Outer Space Treaty prohibits the United States from putting space-based interceptors in outer space. Nothing. You can go back and look at it. It's talking about weapons of mass destruction in outer space, talking about nuclear capabilities in outer space. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about purely defensive capabilities located in outer space. Okay? And if that violates the treaty, then flying ICBMs that go into the exo-atmosphere violates the treaty, which they do not. So the Outer Space Treaty has nothing to do with putting defensive capabilities in outer space. I hear that talking point that come up. I hear it in the media. It makes me crazy. It does not do that. We're not talking about violating treaties here. On the strategic stability question, though, the MDR repeatedly says that we believe, and I believe, that missile defense is stabilizing. There is already a gap. Michael talked about there are more offensive missiles than there are defensive capabilities. That's destabilizing. And as our adversaries continue to invest in missile capabilities, we should be looking to devalue those offensive capabilities. How do you do that? Well, you have defensive capabilities. Not the ability to intercept every single one, but again, providing sufficient defense that you create this doubt in their mind that an offensive attack would be worth the cost, either by us intercepting, hopefully, everything that they can, but at least some of it so that we can then provide limit the damage that they can do and then have an offensive response in retaliation. So all of these things are stabilizing. The Russians have their own missile defense system. This never comes up in conversation. I thought it was cheeky that the MDR included a pretty significant outline of the Russian missile defense program, Chinese missile defense program, the fact that the North Koreans are working on a missile defense program. Why? It's in their interest to do so. So why wouldn't the United States also move forward? And we're not using nukes. The Russians use nukes for their missile defense capabilities. So everything that the United States does is to, again, to prevent a conflict from breaking out in the first place. And in the event that deterrence fails, we have the ability to limit damage, to protect that which we value most to the best of our ability, and have options to respond offensively then in the event that, unfortunately, a military conflict does break down. So that's where I see it. I see it as missile defense at this point can only be viewed as stabilizing in the current threat environment.
Great. Thank you. Frank?
You know, with regards to the North Korean threat, I think the MDR takes a number of very, very important steps, which I support. Improving and increasing the number of long-range interceptors by 20 for a total of 64. Deploying more sensors. Sometimes in missile defense, we get too focused on the interceptors. I would argue that the sensors that provide you that more refined discrimination capability are just as important, if not more. Because if you have better sensors, that reduces the number of interceptors you need to expend. And I believe that the MDR calls for the deployment of 3 long-range discrimination radars by about 2023. And furthermore, it calls for improvements in the kill vehicle. That is also very, very important. So I think the administration is doing a good job with responding to the threat from North Korea. Now, with regards to Russia, China, and missile defense, I've spent a lot of my career in rooms with the Russians and the Chinese on these issues. They truly believe that the United States is building the Death Star that is circling the Earth with the key objective of undermining their strategic deterrent. Now, some people kind of dismiss this, but you know, there's an old Russian saying, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean people aren't out to get you.
The Russian saying?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I don't know any Russian, but I'll get the translation for you. Listen, I don't see a missile defense solution to the challenge from Russia in China. They have too many missiles, and they have very sophisticated capabilities. We need to rely on nuclear deterrence to deal with Russia and China. And that's why I've been very, very much in favor of the Strategic Modernization Program. Teresa, you're absolutely right about space-based missile defense capabilities. The Russians and the Chinese see space-based missile defense capabilities as an existential threat to their strategic deterrent. And if you look at their space security diplomacy over the last 25 years, all of those efforts, whether it be the prevention of placement of weapons, weapons in space treaty, or their no first placement resolutions in the United Nations, have been focused on trying to constrain the United States. I would argue that the Russians and the Chinese will do whatever is necessary to maintain an assured second strike capability. Indeed, the investments in hypersonics, from my perspective, by the Russians and the Chinese are fundamentally about maintaining their ability to penetrate U.S. missile defenses. Rebecca is right on the Outer Space Treaty. It only prevents the deployment of weapons of mass destruction in outer space. There is no prohibition whatsoever on us or other nations deploying missile defense interceptors in space. But the key question is that stabilizing? I am one who has some serious questions about this. When I was at the State Department, I spent a lot of my time engaging countries around the world on the need to have a secure, sustainable, and stable space environment. The Trump administration began pretty well in 2017 talking about the need for space norms and to talk with the Russians and the Chinese on space security. Unfortunately, those words have not been met with action. We are not talking to the Chinese about space security. We are not talking to the Russians on space security. We are not mixing it up in the international arena. I would strongly encourage the administration to take a more active role in space diplomacy. I'm not saying that space diplomacy on its own is going to solve the challenges associated with the Russian and Chinese anti-satellite threat. It will not. But it needs to be part of a comprehensive U.S. space security strategy.
Thank you. And Richard?
Let me start with the North Korea issue. I think I'd put it this way. North Korea's behavior in the last few years got everybody's attention and alarmed an awful lot of people. And that, I think, was their approach. That was what they were trying to do. I think they were trying to get attention on it. What they did in the way of all the testing and the frequency and the different types of missiles and all the new varieties and things that came out and all the surprises, as Rebecca mentioned, with this very large mobile ICBM, that got Congress very focused on North Korea's behavior. And you had very strong support in Congress for addressing these issues. Going back to your question about the $4 billion, well, that was Congress saying, yeah, we need to do something about it, and we need to do it now. So Congress has been sort of seized of this issue, if you will. And my view on this, having spent a lot of time in Congress receiving administration budget requests and watching what's going on, is that right now the North Korea behavior has gotten a very strong level of support for missile defense efforts to defend the United States, certainly the homeland, but also our forces deployed overseas, our allies and partners, against the North Korean threat. And that's largely what motivates an awful lot of the MDR. So I think you're seeing an awful lot of the MDR focused on what do we do now and what we do in the future about this threat. And for that, I suspect Congress will have very strong support, because that's where Congress has been given North Korea's action. And sure, we'd like to see North Korea agree to get rid of its nuclear weapons and missiles. But unless and until that happens, I think this is the path that is likely. On the Russia-China stability, I just want to make one other comment. And frankly, I think you and Rebecca hit a lot of points on this. But there's a basic, there's a fundamental relationship that we always need to keep in mind with missile defense, as well as other elements related to deterrence and trying to dissuade armed conflict, which is there is an action-reaction cycle. Right, we know that. Frank mentioned that a lot of what the Russians or Chinese are doing in the way of developing advanced missile technologies seems to be designed to get around our missile defenses. Right, General Hyten has made that point publicly many times. So we don't act in isolation or in a vacuum. Our decisions on our defense capabilities, missile defense in this case, are very much driven by our perceptions of what foreign countries are doing, what they may do in the future, so there's sort of this uncertainty and hedging approach. But there's no doubt that those countries will also observe what we do, and they will react, right? And so there will be this dynamic over time, and that may get us to change our view of what makes sense or emphasis or what we should or shouldn't pursue. But I take Frank's point, I agree with it, that if we do something that the Russians or the Chinese perceive would fundamentally threaten their deterrent capability, they will do something to prevent that from happening, as we would. I mean, just put yourself in our shoes and think if the Russians said, aha, we've got something that will completely undermine your deterrent capability, we would not stand for it, right? We couldn't.
So. Just two last points from me, and then we're going to go to one final round. But on North Korea, the Missile Defense Review also talks about exploring a technology that would be based on an unmanned aircraft and would be essentially a kinetic kill vehicle for boost phase intercept, at least looking into the development of such a technology. So that's worth adding to the mix. And then specifically to back up Frank's point, but also to point out the obverse. Yes, boost phase defense based in space worries Russia and China because it's the only kind of boost phase system that could actually be effective against missiles launched from their interior, which are otherwise done burning before they get anywhere close to where we could be. So that's the physics of why they worry. But the other part of the physics story is that to be close enough to shoot down a missile with any technology that I know of that's even foreseen, you have to be in low orbit, which means you're usually out of position. Anything in low orbit is moving around the Earth all the time, which means you need 20, 30, 40 of these things in space to have one in the right spot. Therefore, the economics work very badly against the defense for any technology I'm aware of today. That could change, but that's the way I see it. So I'm not trying to argue so much with the Russians and the Chinese, but just to underscore some of the constraints and limitations on boost phase defense. So we'll go to one last round here. I think we'll take about three questions and then go back to the panel for wrap-up. Gentlemen here, and then we'll come over. Actually, you guys already had your questions, so I'll come over here and then to the back, if I could.
Yes, Mark Buckingham with the National War College. The Missile Defense Review calls for this long-range prompt strike capability. Now, the U.S. has been saying that it needs that, or DOD has been saying it needs that, going back at least to the 2006 QDR, right? And we've got nothing. We've got nada. So presumably, if we're going to integrate offense and defense and have some sort of attack ops with a prompt long-range strike capability, we're going to have to field something, either something that violates the INF treaty or that's a hypersonic. And so what do you think that the U.S. should field to produce this capability, and what limitations would you advise the administration to put on those sorts of things so as not to be destabilizing?
Thank you. The gentleman here in the front row.
Hi, Duane Neal, Booz Allen Hamilton. I had a question in regard to the space sensor layer. I agree. I mean, it seems very intuitive we have to go to space for a lot of this. My only concern, I was wondering if you all could address it, is whether that becomes somewhat of a Maginot line, given how predictable some of the orbits are, the growth of ASAT technologies, and how any destruction of those satellites could lead to cascading effects with other uses of space for us.
And then finally, in the back.
Hi, Rizwan Lada, fellow at George Mason University. As I've heard you talk about the challenges we have from a budgetary and domestic political standpoint versus some of the calls in the MDR for advancing or examining new technologies, what do you see to be the role of industry in advancing some of these concepts and getting to a point of initial operational capability? Rapid prototyping, relying more on companies' own internal research and development dollars, bringing in outside private funding, et cetera. There may be some ideas you have on how we get over the budget hurdle while still advancing our missile defense mission. Thank you.
So with apologies to others that we don't have time to call on, let me now go back to the panel. And everybody could please just take 2 to 3 minutes to wrap up. So please be selective of which questions you address, starting with Richard and working down.
Okay. Role of industry, advanced technology. Typically, industry is seen as the brain trust of interesting new ideas. And I don't imagine that that's going to change, right? I mean, I think the Defense Department has always partnered with industry and asked them to bring good, new, innovative ideas, concepts, and I have no reason to expect that would change. That's a long-standing relationship. On the space sensor layer or space-based sensors, I guess one of my surprises in the MDR was that it didn't spend more time on that. Every time, as I read through it, it was talking about the benefits of space sensors. It quick jumped to, oh, and by the way, space-based interceptors may be a really beneficial capability. So I was a little surprised there wasn't more in here. Congress has directed the development of a space sensor architecture and I think has pushed much further than that. So I see this as the direction that Congress is pushing the department and the department wants to go anyway, and I assume that that we'll probably see the real answer on that in the upcoming budget request. But I think that's a pretty well-established direction going forward. And on the attack ops and prompt strike, this is an issue that has been discussed for a long time. And I remember having lots of discussions on this on the Hill years and years ago. And it's taken a long time to develop. I don't know what the solution will be. I assume that this will be something that has the services involved. You know, Army, Air Force, Navy will all be part of this discussion. It's actually one of the taskings of the MDR to look at this question and figure it out. And so there's an awful lot of homework in this MDR. 6 to 9 months from now, a whole lot of reports are going to be dropped on desks around the Pentagon with all kinds of suggestions. And I'm presuming that those answers, because they haven't been given yet, won't be reflected in the upcoming budget. But I would think within the next year, we'll have a better idea of what the intention is for that kind of capability. I don't think anybody really knows right now. I don't. I'll put it that way.
Rebecca, over to you.
Can everybody hear me still? My microphone popped off. Okay. I wanted to just make one quick comment again on the stability thing after my two co-panelists talked about it. I will say that the alternative to not closing what I see as a deterrent gap that exists, either with what the United States has done in the nuclear posture review to try to handle some of what Russia is doing with low-yield weapons in theater, and also what the Russians and Chinese are doing with hypersonics, especially as the Chinese try to hold at risk U.S. carriers. We're trying to close that gap. The alternative is to allow our adversaries to have the advantage in this particular dynamic. So that those are our options before us are, do we seek defensives to try to close that gap, or do we allow the scenario to remain as is with our adversaries being able to hold at risk such high-value things that the United States values, whether it's our carriers abroad or our allies. And then on the Russia and China, I mean, the Russians oppose Aegis Ashore in Romania and Poland. The Chinese oppose THAAD in South Korea. They throw a fit every time we increase our defenses with our Japanese partners with Aegis. The SM-32A now that we've been working with the Japanese, we're going to be testing against an ICBM-class target mentioned in the Missile Defense Review. They're going to be upset about that kind of thing. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese are going to oppose missile defense every step of the way. So if that's going to be the argument that we hold on to not build U.S. defenses, I think we might as well just stop and pack it up and go home, which I argue is not in the interest of the United States of America. So,
great. Good closing comment.
Just four quick points. One, with regards to industry, I think cooperation with industry is key. Perhaps there are some lessons that missile defense can take from the space industry. We have Virgin Galactic and a number of other space companies that are really making some dynamic changes in lowering the cost to have access to space. So perhaps there are some lessons there. On the space-based sensor layer, if we can get it to work, it will dramatically improve our ability to conduct missile defense operations. But the ASAT threat is growing. The Russians and the Chinese and others know the advantages that the United States gets from space. That's one of the reasons why they are investing in anti-satellite capabilities. And, you know, at the beginning, at the end of the Obama administration, and throughout the Trump administration, we've been looking at efforts to improve the resiliency of those systems, and I think that is key. With regards to deep strike capabilities, I absolutely agree. We need to develop deep strike capabilities that can hold Russian and Chinese targets at risk. In my piece on the Missile Defense Review, where I question the administration's focus on trying to defend against the Russian and Chinese regional threat, I talk about the need to develop perhaps a conventional variant of the long-range standoff nuclear cruise missile that can hold at risk key Russian targets. And finally, let me just make a point about allies and partners. The Missile Defense Review has some great language on cooperation with allies and partners. Indeed, I think it's some of the best language that I have seen in any U.S. missile defense policy document. But here's the challenge. President Trump has been very, very critical of our allies, specifically at the missile defense rollout event at the Pentagon. He used that as an opportunity to criticize the allies for not spending enough on defense. Now, listen, if there's anybody in Washington who's been banging the tin cup on missile defense cooperation for the last 20 years, it's been me. But we also need to remember the important role that our allies play in defending the United States homeland. The radars in Greenland, the United Kingdom, and Japan directly support the defense of the United States homeland from ballistic missile threats. And the president should be reminded of that fact.
Very good. Another great point to finish on. Well, thank you all for being here today, and please join me in thanking the panel.